Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began a conversation with Nila Bhattacharya Saxena about her book, Absent Mother God of the West, A Kali Lover's Journey into Christianity and Judaism. A little bit about our guest. Dr. Bhattacharya Saxena is a professor of English and Women's Studies at Nassau Community College in New York. She wrote her 2004 book, In the Beginning is Desire, Tracing Kali's Footprints in Indian Literature, to communicate her connection to a much misunderstood fierce Indian goddess. She has a blog at Stand Under the Mother Principle, and you can read more about her there and her other publications. But without further ado, we would like to introduce Nila once again to Common Threads. Hello, Nila.
Hello, Fred. Thank you very much.
Certainly. To recap, last week we talked about Kali, who is a goddess in the Hindu pantheon. She has a very fierce outer nature. So I will begin to describe her, and you can add anything you want. Kali is midnight black. She has four arms, which most Hindu deities do, with weapons in them. There's usually a sword in one hand, a human head in another. She has a necklace. Sometimes the necklace is of human skulls. Sometimes the necklace is made up of human heads. And she is standing victoriously with her foot on the body of Shiva. And again, it has a very fierce nature. People coming from different traditions may look aghast at something like this, may have a challenge believing that such a form is worthy of worship, of veneration. But Kali worship is very, very popular, especially in the state of Bengal, which is where you're from. Do you want to add anything to that of how I've just described Kali?
Well, as I said last week, there are many, many different forms, and Kali is ubiquitous in Bengal. Kali also, you know, there are various kinds of worshippers. There are those who simply look at her as another form of divinity, another mother god. There are those who want to know more, and then they go deeper. There is a level of devotion, bhakti. There are wonderful songs written about Kali. In Bengal, people do not look at her as she's standing triumphantly, you know, victoriously on Shiva at all, because that's not what the idea is. Because, as I said last week, that icon has many layers of meaning. You know, consciousness and energy, Shakti and Shiva aspect. And then you have Adya Kali, who actually creates both Shiva and Shakti from her womb, which is, I describe Kali as pregnant nothingness in my first book in order to capture the paradox. And you can see that what happens in Bengal, actually, looking at the history of Bengal, you'll find that it was totally Buddhist for many, many years, hundreds of years actually, until you know, actually somewhere around 1000 to 1200 CE, there is a period when a lot of these traditions started to mingle, Sufi Islam, you know, Tantric Buddhism, Shakta traditions. They all mingled and created a very, what I call a kind of a, you know, ambience, Kali ambience. An understanding of what the Buddhists call emptiness. So again, the icon has many meanings, and then there are hundreds of different kinds of icons. Because in India, people believe that each being is on a different spiritual journey. Each being is given a particular icon for meditation, for growing deeper into yourself, where this liberating knowledge resides in. But it is not one size fits all. So that's why even within Kali, you have so many different forms. But the fierce aspect is the most important aspect, because you have to be prepared to face death and, you know, the weapons and the cut-off head. She's destroying your ego, destroying that aspect that is covering over the liberating knowledge.
When the Western academics first came to India to study the scriptures and the religion, say a couple of hundred years ago, those people like Max Müller and the people who were referred to as either Orientalists or Indologists, they pretty much communicated to the West that Hinduism was polytheistic. And I know that there was a movement within Hinduism years ago to say, no, that you have it wrong because we believe that all of the deities ultimately represent one absolute divinity. And so there was a movement to refer to Hinduism, within Hinduism, as monotheistic. But then there, I see in recent years a rebellion against that to say, no, we're not monotheist either. And we don't need people from the West to use their paradigms to define us for ourselves. Would you agree with that?
Yes, generally I will agree with that. Because the term monotheism, polytheism, they're all arising out of a particular history. The history of monotheism, which arose in the Near East for all sorts of... There were powerful goddesses before monotheism arose in the, you know, the Hebrew Bible, the story of it. And so what is happening when people go to these, you know, traditions that are unfamiliar, they are superimposing the terminologies that they are familiar with. That there is either monotheism or there is polytheism. I prefer non-theism, which is because we have many theistic traditions in India. We have many non-theistic traditions in India. And even within the Dharma stuff, there is an atheistic tradition. So India is such a complex, you know, place. But unfortunately, what I see with monotheism, it is a homogenizing impulse, which India always resisted, mainly because of the Great Mother. The homogenizing impulse is an imperial impulse, that everybody must worship one god or else. That kind of tradition never really existed in India. Polytheism, the term polytheism comes from the understandings of, say, the Greek pantheon, that there are many, many different gods and goddesses and people are worshipping. But they're all very particular, coming out of the particular history of that culture. So that's why I will resist both terms. For example, the ultimate reality, even within the Vedantic tradition, which is Brahman, we call it ultimate reality. We do not call this God, because the word God has all of these connotations. And the other problem is that what I call this, you know, transcendentalizing adventure, a God standing outside of the universe, looking at, you know, which is the father God of monotheism, that particular construction is very peculiar to the biblical tradition. So we need to make sure that that clarity is given. But what I discovered in my journey, deeper and deeper you go to any tradition, you will discover this feminine divine, which is a very different articulation. So yes, I would agree, giving these monotheism, polytheism, it creates confusion.
So let's talk about something that we didn't get to last week, which is part of the title of your book, A Kali Lover's Journey into Christianity and Judaism. Tell us about that journey. What did you discover?
Oh my goodness. It is the most amazing journey. What had happened that when I was writing that Kali book, I began to wonder what happened to the Mother God in Christianity and Judaism. Around the same time, I discovered a book called Longing for Darkness, Tara and the Black Madonna by China Galland. And I was struck by this mother hunger in her and her discovery of something called a Black Madonna in Europe. Now, I did not plan anything. I was just going to a conference. It was a group called International Association for Philosophy and Literature, which would meet in Europe. while I will go to the conference, read my papers, and I will travel. I travel extensively in Europe, literally searching for the Mother God. And I started to have amazing experiences. And when I saw the Black Madonna in Einsiedeln, right outside of Zurich, I had an extraordinary feeling that the land is saturated with this, some sort of a black divinity that I am. But of course, I'm also, you know, skeptical. I said, well, I may be just simply superimposing my own Kali consciousness in this black, you know, divinity. But it intrigued me very much that, okay, it makes sense if you have a dark female divinity in so-called, you know, African countries or Latin American countries. But why would you have one in Zurich, right outside of Zurich in Switzerland? Made no sense. So then I started to dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and I discovered this amazing, amazing history. Then I started to read about Mary Magdalene, and at the same time, I suddenly realized there are so many feminist theologians, historians, philosophers who are all searching for that lost mother consciousness. And I began to discover them. I began to read about them. I discovered Mary Magdalene. I discovered Gnostic Christianity. And that is the journey in the book. I call, Shakti Shekhinah, which is the Jewish divine mother figure. I call Yogini Magdalene. I connect them with my own tantric understanding of the black divinity, the black mother figure. And that was the exhilarating journey. It was also a unifying journey. I deeply connected with this suppressed and yet powerfully present in the land, in the consciousness, and the reemergence of this healing energy, actually. I discovered how oppressive, certain articulations of, you know, say, evil Eve versus the Virgin Mother, the split feminine, and how all those things began to kind of merge in the healing figure of the Black Madonna. So I kind of weave this story in this book, my journey into texts, into lands, and my own psycho-spiritual connection with this amazing figure.
Now, we're talking about comparing the Western traditions of Christianity and Judaism, along with the feminine principle that exists within Hinduism and Buddhism.
Right.
Now, but there is no guarantee, I would posit, that a culture that honors the mother principle, that venerates it in a deified form, there's no guarantee that the women, the flesh and blood women in that culture, are necessarily going to be any better off. For instance, it could be argued easily that the people in Northern Europe, who are mainly Protestant, who do not venerate the Virgin Mary in the same way that the Southern Europeans do, that they express more of a feminist ideal in their actual society than the people in Southern Europe. Comment on that. And so what I'm getting at is then, how does this understanding, this veneration of a female mother divinity, how does it affect life in general for flesh and blood women in Asian countries?
Right. Now, this is, of course, a very contested area. Unfortunately, what has happened is, again, the androcentric notions have been superimposed. And I have written about that, in my other articles and in my book also. What I'm talking about here is a psycho-spiritual identity. Patriarchy took over the whole world over. And what does patriarchy mean? Even patriarchy is not necessarily just the rule of the father, what that actually means. It is the rule of the father in the socio-economic political scene. But what about the psycho-spiritual identity of women? And whether women are better off, now I have begun to discover that actually patriarchy hurts men tremendously, because it creates a curtailed understanding. They have to completely deny the yin aspect, the shakti element in them, and as a result, this excessive hyper-sexualized, hyper-violent, hyper-masculine image is presented. So I am not very confident that whether women are better off. What is the meaning of better off? What does it mean? Just to have, for example, you may have all the powers in the world, all the privileges in the world, and yet may feel completely hollow. But of course, that does not mean everybody is feeling that way either. So oppression has many different layers. That is, from my perspective, you have to fight against the social, political, economic, and all these other aspects of patriarchal oppression. But until you liberate yourself, sometimes you have internalized all of these things. Sometimes you begin to believe that you are inferior, whether it is the race aspect or the gender aspect. But how do you cleanse yourself from all that conditioning? So this particular, what is so extraordinary about the Indian tradition, that one, that it retained all those different layers. And as a result, developed technologies that, you know, you could call them technologies, that actually, whether it is yoga, body-centric practices, which actually helps people get out of the almost schizophrenic, again, that's probably not a good word to use, what is called a radical metaphysical dualism in Western tradition, where the male and the female, all the polarities have been hierarchically organized, and one has the right to oppress or control the other. So from my perspective, I'm changing the dynamic of the dialogue. And I'm saying that for some women, this internal freedom is vital. This internal freedom of joyful existence and recognizing the numinosity of everything in the body. Let me tell you a little bit about why I even thought of writing this book.
Yeah, and I want you to do that, but let me break in for just a moment to tell everyone that you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and Neela Bhattacharya Saxena is our guest today. We're talking about her book, Absent Mother God of the West, A Kali Lover's Journey into Christianity and Judaism. So please, go right ahead, Neela.
Okay, so I mentioned in my book that I created a course called The Goddess in World Religions in my college, and actually the journey and teaching of the course and the research, they all kind of were going at the same time. And what I discovered in my classes, that young women in the United States are so, so oppressed by body images. So many young people, young women, and I was very intrigued. I said, how is it possible that this is the most privileged country in the world, sometimes called post-feminist, and so many people suffer from this body problems? And I realize, and again, I do all this stuff in my classes, you know, what does the word goddess mean? Even the word goddess is some sort of voluptuous, sexualized deity, and I write extensively in my book about that. I give examples of the split thing. So you, so on the one hand, you have extreme puritanical fear of the body. On the other hand, you literally begin to consume your body. So I said, and then I will do these things in my classes, a little bit of experiments with simple breathing, yoga stuff, and bringing women to consciousness, bringing them to, you know, to recognize how they're falling into these, you know, traps that are pitting them against, you know, an extremely consumerist culture where everything marked as female and body is for consumption in some form or the other, whether it is the earth and whether it is the female body, and women fall into that trap. So, and my students will actually begin to see that when they connect with all kinds of different goddess figures. They also began to see. One student actually remembered this. I write that very movingly. I was so moved, a young 18-year-old woman who remembered the class after a whole, you know, and the semester had ended, and she remembered something that I, you know, many, many feminist theologians have also been talking about that. How, so I kind of articulated that, that if you take the word mater out of materialism, you actually fall into materialism. Mater is mother. The matter, mater, they're all connected with the feminine principle. But when you do not recognize the divinity, the numinous quality of whatever people call matter, and pit it against something called spirit, then what happens that you not only destroy everything, you never really recognize that that is the playground of the Great Mother. You disrespect your body, you disrespect somebody else's body, because somewhere in the depth of the unconscious that that is something, a fallen thing. It is, you know, that you need to run away into some sort of a other world. So, again, I do not deny that all, it has no guarantee. Just because you have a goddess, that doesn't mean that you are not oppressed. Oppression has many, many different layers. But on the other hand, you may have all the, and I have been talking to many, many people about this also, that yes, even after not having any socioeconomic, political, you know, oppressive things, you still feel oppressed inside. So that's my little, you know, explanation.
I appreciate that.
But no easy answers to that.
Apparently not. You refer in the book a couple of times, I believe, to a term, circular mythology. What is circular mythology?
Okay. I play a lot with geometry because, after all, you know, tantras have yantras and mandalas where you have you practice with these various geometric formations. Now, the linear mythology, that at least at the level of the biblical story, that there is a beginning and there is an end. And the, all the stories, the biblical stories, which are also mythologies after all, they have a way of looking at reality in a linear way. While in India, because there are stories inside the stories and inside the stories, and it is circular because there is no beginning and there is no end. That's why my first book is called In the Beginning is Desire, not In the Beginning was the Word, right? It's not something happened in the past. So past, present, and future, they're all merging in that circle. And the mythologies are also telling stories of past lives, future stories, and you see the same thing in the Buddhist stories also. The Buddha remembers his past lives. So it is entering into a kind of timelessness. The Greeks have two words, chronos and kairos. Chronos is the chronology, kairos is the creative moment. So the circular mythologies, that's why there is no ultimate evil in India. If you look at the history of, say, Ravana, then you find that, well, you know, he's
We have to tell people who Ravana is. Who's Ravana?
Okay. Well, Ravana is the, in the epic of Ramayana, he's the bad guy. You know, he's the one who steals Sita, and then Ram has to kill him and, you know, restore Sita. So Ravana is one of the figures that is seen as this, you know, demonic figure. But as soon as you dig a little bit deeper into the history of Ravana, then you find, well, he's just part of this whole Leela, which is the play of, you know, reality. And he comes from, so he needs to be, he is there on purpose. He needs to be killed by Rama in order to liberate himself from his expanded ego, like he has 10 heads, right? So again, this is why there is so much confusion about Indian stories, because they are not linear or simple. When you go deeper into Christianity and Judaism, you find the same thing. It's not that simple either. But in India, you have, this is why I just created the term circular mythologies, because they're part of this understanding of a different understanding of time.
But one other term that you use briefly, we only have a couple of minutes left, but first of all, gynocentric, that's a word that you use. And then there's also that use with matrix, gynocentric yes. matrix. Could you briefly describe right. that in just a minute or two?
Right. Gynocentric with a capital G. A lot of people use the word gynocentric in all kinds of literary criticism. I use it with a capital G to express this Shakta sensibility, the Shakti principle, the mother principle. And by gynocentric, I simply mean is the immersion into this mother consciousness. And that consciousness creates a different understanding of reality. It also dissolves this extreme polarization between male and female, you know, light and dark, any way you want to look at the polarities. So it's just, and the gynocentric matrix, by that I mean, I said that in India, under the patriarchal thing, and there are tremendously messed up history and terrible, terrible things that happen in India, and I also resist Indian patriarchy in all kinds of forms. But what I mean by the gynocentric matrix, it is that underground sensibility that has sustained India. And the word matrix also is connected with the Buddhist understanding of the interconnected web of existence. That is a very tantric understanding. So in this entire interconnected realities, it is a profoundly freeing expression. You connect with the mother principle and you can see the dance of Shiva Shakti yin yang inside you. And again, it's part of the practice. There are certain things that you can gather from the books, from the knowledge, but then you have to actually practice and recognize how that can transform your reality.
Well, Neela, I want to thank you so very much for joining us this week and last week as well. It's a fascinating study, and I was very impressed with it. We've been speaking with Neela Bhattacharya Saxena. The book, Absent Mother God of the West, A Kali Lover's Journey into Christianity and Judaism. And briefly, Neela, tell us about your blog where people can connect with you.
Right. Actually, I also have a website that has all the information, which is simply neelabhattacharyasaxena.com, that has a link to my blog, which is Stand Under the Mother Principle. It also gives you more information about my book and my earlier book and links to my other publications, so people can go there if they want to.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Fred. It was a great pleasure, and I thank you and thank the entire station for that.
You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. Please join us again next week for another edition. I'm Fred Stella.